Now we're going to talk a little bit more about the history of
Are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay.
I didn't hear our intro. I guess we're on.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and once again, I'd like to welcome our listeners to the Socialist Insight. Today, we have Alan Mackey. He's joining our program once again. He comes on every other week, and he brings a lot of useful information so the left can understand the left. We can understand things that we're the demands that we're placing, that are demands that are relevant to working people, and what we need to do to achieve those achieved results. And Alan, once again, I'd like to welcome you to the program today.
Well, thanks for having me again, Stuart.
Alan, I have to apologize. I usually get a cue that I'm a countdown, and I know when I'm ready to start the program, and all of a sudden, are you there? Am I here? So anyway, I had to apologize for that. And Alan, this is going to be a very interesting program. Every time I have you on the program, Alan, you always make it very interesting. You're so involved. I'm going to speak later about a recent forum that you were involved there in Minnesota, the Duluth Forum, and some of the things that came out of that. But today, Alan, what we're talking about is a left agenda for 2014 and what the left should be demanding and what the left must do to achieve that. And, Alan, what I'd like to start out with is recently you and many other people received a letter from Senator Bernie Sanders to participate in on a telephone conference where you can list some of the directions that the left should be taking for an agenda in 2014 and moving forward. I'm not certain if Senator Bernie Sanders is the right person to lead us into the future for the left, but nevertheless, he's brought us some things to generate some conversation in that area. And Alan, you just received that letter. When is this telephone conference supposed to take place, by the way?
Geez, let's see here.
I think it's in a couple of weeks on the last week of this month. Is that it?
I think that it is. You have to send it. In fact, I don't even have it in front of me right now.
But that's quite all right. What I wanted to do is one of the things that I was very interested in, you actually responded to that. And
right.
You indicated some things that the left really needs to be talking about, things that need to be addressed by not only the left, but things that should be talked about by this senator that's saying that he represents the left, that he is a socialist right there in Washington, D.C. And, Alan, you know, first of all, I'm looking beyond where you thank the senator for the invitation, which, as I mentioned, this went out to thousands of other people, but you have already said that you will be participating. But one of the things you say that the left, first of all, we should be, there are many problems that the senator should be addressing. We need to first, and right at the top of your list, you mentioned that the Senate, this government should be focusing on a 21st century Full Employment Act for Peace and Prosperity, which would take up from where the New Deal left off. Now, you have mentioned that many, many, many times about a 21st century Full Employment Act. It is possible. Is a 21st century Full Employment Act, and what would it do for working class people today?
Well, the concept comes from the 1945 Full Employment Act, which was introduced by Congressman Wright Patman. It actually passed the United States Senate in 1945 under a great deal of pressure from the labor unions, which were very militant and well-organized at that time. About a dozen of those labor unions in the CIO were very left-led unions, including the International Longshore the United Electrical Workers, and a number of other unions, including the UAW. But they brought so much pressure to bear on the United States Senate, the Senate was forced to pass the vote for the 1945 Full Employment Act, which would have required the President and the United States Congress to work together to attain and maintain full employment. At that time, full employment was only about 2% right after World War II. And the Chamber of Commerce and all these Wall Street outfits, National Association of Manufacturers, got all upset because they saw their power essentially evaporating in front of them and labor taking over. And they came into this fighting full force, and they were able to convince the United States Congress to defeat this legislation. This is where the attack on labor actually started after World War II. A lot of people think it started with Joe McCarthy, but it actually started with a group of Democrats that were opposed to the Full Employment Act of 1945. In fact, they even red-baited Wright Patman over this and several other members of Congress. But when it was largely based on Keynesian economics, which means that they want to create just enough jobs and raise wages just enough in order to keep the economy going to so people can get into the market to buy things, and that's supposedly supposed to keep the capitalist economy rolling along. Well, I think a 21st century Full Employment Act has to look at this much differently and forget about the Keynesian economics and focus on the same thing that the 1945 Act did, which would make the President and Congress responsible for attaining and maintaining full employment. But it has to look at, and it has to, a big part of this has to be creating government programs, massive government programs to create jobs. We're talking about things like a national public health care system, a national public child care system. Those things combined would create almost 20 million jobs in this country, good-paying jobs, providing the American people with free health care through neighborhood and community health care centers, and the same thing with child care centers. And these would be publicly financed, publicly administered, and publicly delivered, just like our public schools are. So there's really nothing that's controversial about this at all. The only thing controversial is if the United States government should spend, you know, literally trillions of dollars to develop these kinds of programs. And I think that this is what the left needs to take up in this country if we're going to be successful in fighting back against what Wall Street is trying to do to us, destroy our standard of living and keep pushing us into these wars.
Well, what you say here, you say President and Congress need to be made responsible by an act of Congress for obtaining and maintaining full employment. The President and Congress.
Right.
I mean, there's no accountability in Washington at all. The only thing that they're accountable in Washington, the only accountability in Washington is only to Wall Street. They have they have the people, their lobbyists to come in there and fill the halls of the Capitol, and they're the only ones that they're responsible to. But right here you say the President and Congress should be made responsible. There's no accountability in Washington, D.C. It's on autopilot right now, Alan. So,
right.
I mean, how would this be done if there's an act of Congress?
Right, and it has to make them responsible. I don't think people fully understand that accountability is a main part of democracy. We have all these politicians walking around talking about jobs, when it comes to them wanting votes to get elected. But then once they're elected, we don't see any jobs, and the jobs that we do see are the most pitiful jobs you can imagine. Here in Minnesota, the Democratic Farmer Labor Party was boasting, 10 years ago they would boast that they created 44,000 jobs in the Indian gaming industry. Well, when we started organizing this industry, we exposed before the public that these were jobs that forced 44,000 Minnesotans to work in loud, noisy, smoke-filled casinos at poverty wages and without any rights under state or federal labor laws. And the Democrats stopped talking about these jobs that they created very quickly after we exposed all this. But these are the kinds of jobs the Democrats have created. We see Democrats bringing in all these Walmart stores. They get involved in bringing in Menards. I know people that work in Menards. They're working part-time jobs, 12 and 14 hours a week, and they're getting $8.50 an hour. This is pitiful. You know, this is poverty, and they're enforcing poverty through legislation and all these zoning ordinances that are allowing the Walmarts and the Menards and the Target stores to come in. So, you know, these are the kinds of jobs the Democrats have created, and the Republicans too. They've worked together to create these kinds of jobs. And we got to, you know, every job is actually a good job if it pays a real living wage and the workers
right.
have rights and they're working in a safe and healthy working environment. That's a good job.
Well,
the Democrats,
well, let's look at what you say about jobs. You say minimum wage, and this is part of that letter that you have written, because you're asking for accountability from the senator before he comes in to say, you know, a lot of things that sound good but have no substance to it. You say a minimum wage should become a real living wage based on actual cost of living, then index
right.
to inflation. It does no good to index a poverty wage to inflation with periodic increases provided to improve the living standards of working people. But basically what you're saying is people, when they look at their legislators and they're talking about minimum wage, it should be a real living wage. That's what we're talking about here, because you say every job can be a good job if it can provide a good standard of living. Is that correct?
Right. Correct. And when we say living wage jobs, there has to be something to compare wages to when we're talking about wages. And the thing that we have to compare wages to is what the old union leaders used to compare wages to, and that's cost of living. These old union leaders, they won increases in the standard of living in the contracts they negotiated. Since the mid-1960s, there hasn't been a single union contract in this country that's made an improvement in the lives of working people. Almost every single contract that's been negotiated has been concessions.
You say since when? You say it hasn't been once?
Since about the mid-1960s. In one way or another, the unions have been giving back everything to the companies little by little, and now the pace has quickened. And you have union leaders like Richard Trumka. I just read an article that he wrote today for the Root magazine, and he says he supports a 10-10 minimum wage. You know, what kind of union leader? We got to realize Richard Trumka is a millionaire, sits as the head of the AFL-CIO, and this guy is calling for a 10-10 minimum wage, which is a poverty wage by any standards that you want to use. Richard Trumka knows something about cost of living, although he doesn't like to talk about that because he's got so much money, he can go into stores and buy anything he wants. So really the prices of things don't mean anything to him. But to working people go into a grocery store nowadays and they need milk, they need bread, they need meat, and they have to make a choice. What will they buy? What will they feed their families? They can't afford the price of the same cuts of meat that Richard Trumka can. So, you know, they choose cheap things like a hamburger, which is an outrageous price in itself. At the local store here, you can't get hamburger for less than $4.50 a pound, and it's nothing but fat, you know.
Right.
And this is the way that they're ripping people off left and right. You go into the grocery store and all kinds of things. You buy canned goods. More and more water is being added to those things, less and less product. You look at the meats and more fat and bone is being added, you know, and yet we're paying big prices for all this stuff. If you look, you go fill your gas, your car up with gas, you get robbed at the pump. You get ripped off when you're paying for electricity. Electricity rates are going out of sight. These are the basic things, the basic necessities of life that working people need to survive. And all these things are rising in price out of proportion to all the other things that, you know, the wealthy people would buy as luxuries. So the
right.
standard of living is being drastically cut for working people, and this is something that we have to address with the minimum wage. All these politicians, the Democrats, went around talking about how they were for a living minimum wage to get elected. Now that was the bait to get our votes. Now they pulled a switch, and they're talking about anywhere from $7.60 an hour to $8.50 and $9 and $10 an hour. I don't hear.
Yeah, and that's poverty for anyone.
No one.
I mean, even a family. You can have a family of four, and everyone in the family is working. You cannot live on $9 an hour. You can't live on $8 an hour. It's impossible.
Right.
You,
I was just talking
yeah,
to a statistician from the Bureau of Labor Statistics today, Stuart, and he told me that $9.50 an hour for the minimum wage is comparable to what $1.25 was back in 1963. So,
wow.
You know, this is moving backwards. At the time Martin Luther King led the March on Washington, he was calling for a $2 an hour minimum wage, which would be just under $16 an hour today. So how is it that these labor leaders and these Democrats and all these foundation-funded outfits are calling for a minimum wage of between $7.60 and $10 an hour? This is taking us way, way backwards.
And Alan, I was making $8 an hour 35 years ago.
Yeah.
35 years ago. And that was considered a good income. You know, I was working as a retail clerk. And if you weren't a clerk, I mean, if you were a clerk, but you weren't like a journeyman, you were still making $6 an hour. And that was considered good income. And here we're talking about just $8 an hour and the cost of living, I mean, it has gone through the stratosphere.
Yeah. Bernie Sanders is, you know, he says he's a socialist, and I take his word for it. But he seems to have joined these Democrats in pushing their agenda rather than pushing a socialist agenda and a very progressive agenda for working people. Bernie Sanders is also supporting the 10-10 minimum wage. And what one thing that really bugged me about is the letter that he sent was that he's bought into this whole economic populism that's being pushed
right.
by Robert Reich and Joe Stiglitz and all these people. And if you notice in reading his letter, he not once mentions militarism or
never,
these wars.
Never.
And
right.
How do you talk about solving any of the problems in this country without talking about ending the wars and stopping militarism? Common sense says that you're either going to spend money on wars or you're going to spend money on things that people need. And this is one of the things that Wright Patman made when he introduced the 1945 Full Employment Act. It was his thinking, and he publicly stated this, that if the politicians had to focus on creating jobs in this country, they wouldn't be able to indulge in all these insane military adventures all over the world. That was his own words, and that was one reason why he thought it was so important that we go ahead and try and force the President and Congress to implement full employment in this country, because he didn't want them to spend all their time on militarism and wars. And he was right. You know, we see what's happened ever since. And this, since the end of World War II, this country has been engaged almost every year in war after war after war.
It's been one war after, it's been a conflict, a war, or a full-scale invasion where we've been invading a country like what we did at Libya.
Yeah, and often you're talking about this country being involved in 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 conflicts at the same time. And we still haven't paid for the Spanish-American War way back in the late 1800s.
Right.
We're still paying interest on that war. And, you know, nobody
exactly.
knows how much we're actually paying for these wars because supposedly nobody's keeping track. I've tried to get the figures from members of Congress, and nobody, either they won't tell me or they really don't know. But nobody knows the interest that we're paying on funding all these wars. And it's the bankers that are making profit on all this interest. So
I'm looking at what you said here. First of all, you mentioned what you sent also to Bernie Sanders in these dirty imperialistic wars and choke off support to Wall Street's military industrial complex, tax the hell out of the rich, tax
right.
Wall Street transactions and profits, and then you say this is the way, and this is what Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders, should be hearing. This is the way we fund the universal social programs required to improve the lives of American people, which will provide jobs to millions of people. This is what the senator, he doesn't get that.
No, I don't think he does get it. Either he doesn't get it or he knows somebody has told him what to say and what not to say. which I think is probably the case, because he did support Obama both times, and he's been a consistent supporter of the Israeli killing machine. He's never voted against it.
As far as I'm concerned, Bernie Sanders is a Obama supporter, and you know, that doesn't work for me. You mentioned also, and it's just so much that's in this letter, things that the left, this is really speaking from the position of the left. We need to think in terms of putting people to work, solving our social and economic problems, not on a basis of priming the free market, priming what they call for the free market. Because we see the free market, the only thing the free market really does is benefit Wall Street. It benefits the wealthiest in our society. And then you mentioned also socialists think about people, not capitalists, markets, and profits. And this is so correct.
What actually separates socialists from the Keynesian economists. And a lot of people won't realize this, especially a lot of people on the left. We hear a lot of people on the left making Keynes an idol, and they don't realize that the whole purpose behind Keynesian economics is to stimulate markets, in other words, getting people to buy. In fact, Keynes himself talked about he wanted to raise wages, but not too much. And he wanted more employment, but he didn't want full employment because they want to use unemployment as a break and a lever in order to keep wages down. So, you know, Keynes was a Wall Street economist. We have to begin to look and think in terms of, you know, socialist economies. And in a socialist economy, you produce to solve the problems of the people. People's needs are what come first. We obviously need all kinds of industrial production, producing a lot of goods and services, but not for the purpose of stimulating an economy. That is totally different. We can manage an economy and create an economy where the good of the people comes before markets. So, and that's what we should be focused on, especially right now when we got over 20 million people in this country unemployed. The free market created the problem. The so-called free market, the capitalist system, created this problem of unemployment. We can't expect the system that created the problem to solve the problem. That's a very backwards kind of thinking and very wishful thinking to think that can even happen, because the employers today do not want to hire people, and the people they do want to hire, they want to make sure that they force wages down so they don't have to pay them very much, because that pushes their profits up. So they want this large pool of unemployed people, first of all, to keep wages down. Second of all, it allows them and enables them to use these people as union busters. And that's what this whole pool of unemployed people is all about, forcing wages down and to use these people as union busters. So, this is what socialists should be looking at. And Bernie Sanders should be bringing forward real solutions to people's problems. There's, he talks about health care, and he has a lot of good thinking on the health care reforms and everything that he thinks are necessary. But why he can't put these things together, that as long as we're funding wars, we can't fund something like a national public health care system, which every socialist
Well, Alan, let's face it. The only reason why he's not really putting it forward, because he wants to remain popular with the people. You know, this is not a popularity contest. You know, we're dealing with the lives of people. Yeah, so what if you're unpopular? But the thing is, you need to come out, we need to come out and talk about real solutions to the problems that people are facing every day. I see right here, you really hit the senator hard here. You say, and I agree, why has it been so difficult for you as a socialist to advocate socialist solutions to our problems? That's it. I mean, we need to talk about solutions. We don't need to be talking about things that where you're riding the fence, where it's going to sound good, but it's not going to have any achievable results. You say, for instance, the solution to the healthcare mess is as simple as looking to how public education is structured, financed, and delivered, publicly funded, publicly administered, publicly delivered. Alan, that's what this senator should be talking about.
Exactly.
But let's talk a little bit about health care, because you had mentioned it will create millions of jobs, but it can't be done through Obamacare. Ultimately, it can't be achieved through a single-payer health care system. Single-payer is a good step. It moves
right.
us in that direction. It takes the big insurance companies out of the loop. But ultimately, we need to have a national health care system. But explain how that would create jobs and how that should be on the socialist agenda.
Well, we all know that the public education in this country creates millions of jobs for teachers and everybody that works in the public education system, from teachers, janitors, school administrators. It creates millions of jobs. Social Security does the same thing. These are jobs providing for things that people need. In the same way, a national public health care system would deliver free health care to the American people through a vast network of community and neighborhood health care centers all over this country. Thousands of these centers would be providing people with free access to health care. Actually, for the price of what we pay for 800 military bases around the world, we could have a national public health care system. And, you know, building these health care centers would create a lot of jobs. Those would be short-term jobs. But staffing these health care centers would provide millions upon millions of full-time jobs paying good wages. And this is what we got to be looking at. And, you know, you think about this. How come these politicians can come up with funding wars so quickly and so easily and make these decisions so quickly to go to war, but they can't think in terms of providing for the things that people need, like health care, and establishing a national public health care system that's just like public education? No different. It's not controversial.
Well,
that's
a good point, Alan, because just a few weeks ago, within the last 3 months, we see that we were ready to commit to hundreds of billions of dollars to go to war with Syria. We say they crossed the line in the sand. And we had all of Congress, including this president, was ready to sign on the dotted line to spend hundreds of billions of dollars within, Alan, it wasn't even 2 weeks. They said, we're ready to go to war. And if it had not been because of an outpouring of millions of people saying, we do not want another war, we do not want you to go to war with Syria, Alan, we would already have boots on the ground there in, well, not boots, we had drones in the air over Syria.
Yeah, well,
but this, like you say, this is how quick they make decisions to go to war, but they can't make those same decisions for a national health care program. This is what socialists should be talking about. This should
right.
be part of the agenda. But anyway, yeah, go on, Alan.
We know that programs like the Works Progress Administration, the Civilian Conservation Corps, and CETA, the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act, we know that these are proven programs that create millions of jobs and put people to work doing constructive things to in our communities, and yet these politicians don't even look at these kinds of programs to put people to work. People that desperately need jobs. There's no reason why the WPA shouldn't be reestablished in the CCC and CETA. You know, under the WPA, the right-wing attacks this as a bunch of people that were leaning on shovels collecting government checks. Well, what did these people leaning on shovels actually do? They built entire sewer systems for hundreds of communities across this country. They built city halls and civic centers and theaters. You know,
built roads throughout the country.
Roads and bridges.
Developed our parks. I mean, the list goes on and on. I mean,
yeah,
they created millions and millions of jobs, Alan.
The Civilian Conservation Corps planted seedlings that are now being harvested by the forestry industry today. You know, we would have just barren ground in a lot of places in this country if it weren't for the CCC replanting the trees that had already been cut down or we lost the forest fires. So, you know, these were important things that people did, and there's no reason why those programs shouldn't be reestablished today. You know, the sewer systems that were built by the WPA back in the 1930s are now beginning to crumble. They need to be rebuilt and refurbished and taken care of, and that could all be done. We have bridges in this country that are collapsing. A lot of those bridges were built, only 30, 40 years ago. Bridges that the WPA built, I've never heard of a single one collapsing, you know.
Right.
So, these people did excellent work, quality work, and, why aren't we looking at reestablishing these programs today? What is it about the politicians that are in office today that they can't think in terms of developing programs like this? John Conyers did come across with a good jobs-creating program, but it doesn't have any chance at all of success in Congress. And this is a real shame. Here we have all this unemployment, and these people in Congress can't even deal with a job-creating program after they go around this country talking about jobs to get elected. And unless we put a package together like what we're talking about, a 21st Century Full Employment Act for Peace and Prosperity, that would include all these things as a package, including a real living minimum wage and, a guaranteed annual income, if that's what we need, if they're going to keep forcing people to work at these part-time jobs, that should all be part of a package that should be put together, and we should take from where the New Deal left off and modify that to what we need in the country today. And we need a lot of these universal social programs if we're going to survive as the people. And, how people are going to manage without these kinds of things, I don't know. It's going to be very rough and very scary.
Well, what I'm going to do, Ellen, I'm just going to make a very brief intro to our program again today. We have Alan Mackey. He's joining our program. He joins us every other week, and Alan brings us a lot of useful information where it's definitely pertaining to the left. And our discussion today is a left agenda for 2014. We're going to get into a few other things, even talking about the President's State of the Union address, which is coming up in a few days. But, Alan, once again, I'd like to thank you for joining the program, as always.
Well, thanks for having me.
Alan, I read some of these things when I'm putting together my program from week to week, and I hear these things, which sounds absolutely absurd, where they talk about these programs that help start bringing the New Deal and programs that were helping to create jobs, real jobs, what you were just talking about, the Conservation Corps, jobs that were created through the Works Projects Administration, jobs that came along later, which was CETA, as I mentioned to you earlier before the show. I was part of a program like that. But, Alan, when we see these programs, as I look through the Internet, they talk about the empty successes that these programs had. And these jobs were very successful. The only thing is, the jobs that were created, the work that was created, they were creating real jobs. Subsequently, what we could see as a result of that, we shifted our priorities from creating jobs to a wartime economy. Because in the late 30s, first of all, they said that we had come approximately 25% out of the recession, the depression at that time. Once war happened in 1941, it ended the depression. But the depression could have been ended if we had stayed on track for a peacetime economy. Now, Alan, you have already explained a little bit about – I want you to explain a little bit about those two programs, those three programs, which we can see the CETA program came as under the Nixon administration. Again, I was reading things where it was mentioning only about the failures of the program, but I could see successes that came about through those programs. So could you just touch bases on the CCC, the WPA, and also the CETA program, how those programs are needed today to create jobs?
Well, those programs were established back in the 1930s by people like Harry Hopkins and Francis Perkins, who were the progressive people within Roosevelt's administration. And especially Harry Hopkins was one of the main architects of these programs. And he understood that it was necessary to He looked around and saw all these things in society that needed to be done, from building parks and campgrounds to planting trees in areas where the trees have been cut down and not replanted and everything else. So he developed all these programs, and they were very successful programs. The right wing likes to attack these programs, like I said, by saying that, it was just a bunch of workers leaning on shovels collecting a government check. The right wing is very dishonest. They never say what the programs accomplished. And this is what we got to point out, that these programs, if private industry were to do what the public did through these programs, we would be heavily in debt today. And almost all these programs, as far as I know, have been paid for. There is no debt to any of these programs. They were all paid for, and we have no deficits or anything related to those programs from the 1930s. They paid for themselves.
The only debt we have, Alan, is debt that has been created by war. If we hadn't had war for the last century, the country wouldn't have any debt.
Exactly. And, you know, like I said, these programs like WPA, all over this country, almost every single city that has a sewer system was built by the WPA. And roads, many places didn't have roads. There were roads created all through the mountains and everything by the WPA and the CCC programs. You know, this would to do these with private contractors and everything would have cost a tremendous amount of money, but it was all done through government-funded projects where nobody made any profits, at least very little profits. And we got to look at these things today, because if we want private contractors to do everything that that was done under the WPA and CCC, we're going to be in debt for literally centuries. And if we do these jobs under a public works program like they did under WPA and CCC, it will cost the American people next to nothing and a lot less than what wars are costing us. So, you know, this is what we got to look at. We also have to look at a public banking system, too, I think, and run all the funds through a public banking system rather than through the private banks. We could have a lot more could have been done under WPA and CCC if they didn't have to run that money through private banks. After all, every time these private corporations, whether it's a bank or a company, makes private profit, that's money that the government can't spend doing something constructive, whether it's building a sewer system or making another park or building another school, where every time we have to pay for profits to these corporations, you know, that's money we don't have to spend on something. And the right wing doesn't like to think in these terms. And the Democrats don't want to think in these terms. For sure, the Republicans don't want to think in these terms. And if socialists don't bring these kinds of this kind of thinking forward, it's not going to be introduced into the public square where people have a chance to mull these things over. It might be controversial to start with. When I started talking about a national public health care system, people would say, "Oh, that's socialism," and then I would start to explain how it's nothing more than how we operate our public schools. And people would say, "Oh, we never thought about it like that." You know?
Right.
So we this is a way to introduce these ideas, and we have to do it. If we don't do it as socialists, nobody else is going to do it. One of the problems, I think, in the socialist movement has been that each little group has rushed to try and put their agenda forward. And I think we sort of got to get away from that. We need to have some kind of large national conference to decide how we as socialists and leftists want to start approaching the problems in this country and what kind of agenda we want to bring forward. So we're all a like mind. We have to have some kind of meeting of the minds, and that's what our conference and our forum in Duluth was about a week ago. We said, you know, we have a lot of dots that got to be connected and all these issues that we're working on, but unless we have a meeting of the minds, we're not going to be able to win any of these struggles. And that's
right.
What it all boils down to. And, you know, we decided
to... And we want to touch on that before the end of our program today, about that forum.
Okay. But it's very important...
Alan, one other thing I wanted to look at here, it was the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act of 1973. It was actually signed into law by President Nixon, And it was actually the administration of that program really got involved under the Carter administration, and then we could see a phasing out of that program in the '80s under the Reagan administration.
Reagan.
Because many of these programs require government assistance, government funding to get them started. But what they do is they create jobs. Jobs create money where it creates generate tax revenues for the country. Unfortunately, instead of the government putting money into these programs, they under the Reagan administration, we could see the government shifted its priorities from creating jobs to putting monies into war. We could see that there was a huge military buildup all the way through the Reagan administration, and we have seen the government dump trillions of dollars into that. Now, what this program, the CETA program, basically, as I mentioned, it started under President Nixon, and as a result of that, millions of people received training and assistance and created jobs. I was able to take advantage of programs like that when I worked in aerospace back in the 80s. But I could see in the early 80s, but I could see that many people were able to go to work through that program. But could you just speak a little bit about the CETA program? I was also, Alan, I see a program, a political statement that was written by Walter Shapiro. This was the CETA program, a 70s government job program that didn't work. And then it's basically, as you read through the article, it says in the late 1970s, the Jimmy Carter administration, in the late 1970s, in the Jimmy Carter administration, I had a ringside seat for the political collapse of the last modern attempt to replicate a massive New Deal jobs program. But the program, it really wasn't a collapse other than it was by decisions that our politicians made to make the program where it would not benefit working people, and they shifted the funding for Wall Street. But could you just share a little bit about the CETA program, and then we're going to move on.
Well, millions of people that never would have had jobs, some of them came from families that were unemployed for generations and living in poverty. Millions of these people got training and jobs, and then they, after they got several months training, they actually got jobs. Jobs working in factories as high-load drivers, jobs working on all kinds of high-tech equipment. A lot of the people that are now working in computers, they had been trained in the CETA program. You had all kinds of people that were trained working in the anti-poverty programs. The anti-poverty programs had been become centers for health care and everything else, and a lot of these people got their training in those programs, and all these programs have now been largely destroyed. So, you know, I don't know how anybody can say that the CETA program was not successful. There were millions upon millions of people that got jobs, good-paying jobs, through the CETA programs. Nobody can deny that. The reason they can't deny it is because we now have people that are retired from many of the jobs that they got into as a result of that program. I know all kinds of people. I'm sure everybody listening knows all kinds of people that they probably wouldn't have ever had a decent job if they hadn't gotten into the CETA program, and that's just a fact of life. And one thing that made the CETA program so successful, especially under Nixon, and I sort of hate to give Nixon any credit for anything, but one of the things that made it such a success is that affirmative action was enforced as part of the CETA program, and people don't
right,
want to
exactly.
talk about this either. You know,
affirmative action and quotas.
Yeah, it was enforced
right.
very strongly, and this is one of the things that made the
affirmative action. That was a very good element of the CETA program.
Exactly, and the CETA program would not have been successful without that element, because politicians would have put their friends into these jobs, and people of color and women and the handicapped never would have had these jobs. It would have just, and in fact, that's what the CETA program degenerated into under Jimmy Carter. All these politicians gave their friends jobs in the CETA programs, and these people, you know, They had relatively high-paying jobs, much higher-paying jobs than the people that had initially been trained in the CETA program. Initially, the CETA programs were very short-term training programs, but the politicians under Jimmy Carter, they turned these into some kind of plum civil service-type jobs where they were getting permanent employment just because they were a friend of somebody, even though the government didn't even need people working at these jobs, and that's what eventually sabotaged the entire CETA program, the corruption that was involved. In Chicago, the corruption involved in the CETA programs were just terrible, in some of the other larger cities. And this is just what, these politicians, they take a good program and they ruin it, and then they say the program didn't work. They sabotaged the program.
We have approximately 10, 11 more minutes, so, and we could actually talk for another 2 or 3 hours. We just recently, and I appreciate you giving just some things that we should be thinking about for a left agenda, because all these things that you're talking about, Alan, these are things that will create a real future for working people. It will take our nation in a different direction, creating good-paying jobs. This is what we need to be thinking about on the left. And once again, I'll say, I don't think Bernie Sanders is the person to lead us into the future for a left agenda. I think it needs to be coming from people like yourself. It needs to be coming from organizations such as the Socialist Party USA, the New Progressive Alliance. That's what it needs to be coming from. Alan, I'm going to move on because we're running short. We have Obama. He just recently came out and made some statements on scaling back the NSA program and how it's been spying not only on U.S. citizens but also heads of states and governments. And this is one of the things that, as socialists and the left, we're demanding into all of the spying into our homes, into our lives, into ourselves, in our workplaces, spying into the affairs of other governments. But, Alan, what are your comments on that, and what should our position as the left be in regards to this government spying on other governments and people in other countries, and, most important, spying on the people that they're supposed to be representing?
Obama came out and said that he's going to stop spying on the leaders of other countries. It's almost a joke if it weren't so sad and tragic. Here we have the government of the United States spying on the elected leaders of probably most of the other countries in the world, and it's become a big source of embarrassment. But to me, the biggest problem with these programs is that they're aimed at crippling democracy in our own country, smothering democracy in our own country. It's an attack on the American people, and it's an attack on our right to discuss and freely associate with one another and discuss our problems and how we're going to solve our problems. This is where the real attack is taking place, and this is what's got to be stopped. The present programs are nothing but a perpetuation of what was called the COINTELPRO programs back in the 1950s, 60s, and into the 70s. And, the COINTELPRO program was a hideous program that involved all kinds of spying and infiltration of progressive organizations and left-wing organizations for no other reason than that J. Edgar Hoover and these people in power had disagreements with the ideas that people were bringing forward, not even what people were doing, but just what people were thinking, even what people were reading. People were watched as to what the library books they checked out and everything else. And this whole NSA spying program is an extension of that. It's now coming out that they have like 3 or 4 layers of things that they go through before they supposedly spy on somebody. And yet they spied on almost every single American in this country by monitoring and putting their telephone calls into bank.
It's going into a database where they're collecting information on hundreds of millions of people.
Exactly. and they have certain words that they can hone
right.
in on to search. And so, you know, every one of us becomes a victim. I just talked to a guy the other day that works in a taconite plant here on the Iron Range in Minnesota, and he was joking with a guy saying they ought to hang these bosses. And there was nobody else there listening, but he come to find out that they made him go see a psychiatrist before they would let him come back to work because they were looking to fire him. And he had to go see a psychiatrist, but he asked the psychiatrist, well, how did they find out that I said that? And the psychiatrist told him that was recorded. So, you know, U.S. Steel has microphones and stuff hidden in the workplace where they're recording what people are saying. And so even a joke turns out to be some kind of threat against the company that they can use to fire a person. And this is where all this is leading to. And, you know, we got to put an end to it. We have organizations like the American Civil Liberties Union. They should have sued a long time ago. There should have been a class action suit against the FBI and NSA and the CIA for all this COINTELPRO crap that they ran against the American people. Millions of people were affected by this. It's a heinous program. But, you know, they haven't done that. Now the American Civil Liberties Union is saying, oh, it's just great that Obama has agreed to stop spying on other on telephone calls from leaders of other countries. Well, I don't see anything great about that. Why did it exist in the first place?
Right,
and now
exactly.
Obama is saying, no, I'm going to stop it. Yeah,
he escalated it.
Yeah, it severely escalated it. Just imagine if they're spying on people like the leaders of Germany and France and all these countries, Italy and Greece, what kind of spying operations do they have going on against the workers' movements in places like Greece and Spain and Portugal, where workers are fighting like hell for their rights and against this neoliberal agenda? You know, how are they spying on the American people? We know by their own admission, the FBI's own admission, that they sent over 500 FBI agents into Occupy Wall Street to disrupt it and destroy it. You know,
right, exactly.
This is our government taking action against people that have committed no crime other than thinking that we can have a society that works better than what we've got
society.
Now under capitalism.
Alan, we have around 5 more minutes here. The president is going to be making his State of the Union address a week from now. What are you expecting to hear from this State of the Union address when he comes to the American people?
Well, I expect the same kind of hypocrisy we've had from Obama all along. He's going to, you know, make a nice speech, but he's not going to follow through on doing anything to set things right. He's not going to, you know, I posted today on my Facebook page a speech that Lyndon Johnson made when he initiated the war against poverty. Well, no matter what people think of Lyndon Johnson, and I think he was nothing but a warmonger the way he orchestrated the war in Vietnam and everything, but Lyndon Johnson did put into place all these anti-poverty programs. He made a speech, and he talked about what he was going to do to start to fight poverty, and he actually did the things that he said he was going to do. And we're not getting that from Obama at all. Poverty is the number one problem in our country today. You know, we have millions upon millions of people living in poverty, and there are wars against people all over the world, but we have no war against poverty. And, you know, Obama should be talking about a war on poverty right here in our own country. That's what he should be talking about. No doubt he will mention poverty, but we will see no programs coming from Obama to fight poverty. That's, you know,
I would like
on that.
I would like for you to spend maybe a couple of minutes talking about the forum that took place there. Could you share that with our listeners, please?
Well, about 140 people came together in Duluth, Minnesota a week ago on Saturday, January 11th, to bring progressives together to talk about these things. And we had a number of speakers with various viewpoints. And we talked about how we could begin to work together, even though we're working on separate issues, but to see how these issues are interconnected and intertwined and how we can better work together to unite and fight to win these things. And we thought that one of the best ways to do this was to focus on the minimum wage at this point. And we drafted a letter, an open letter to Governor Dayton and the Minnesota State Legislature, insisting that the minimum wage be a living wage, the wage that they promised when they were running for election, a real living wage. Now they baited us with that living wage, and we're accusing them of a bait and switch by bringing forward a poverty wage. And this is the main thing that came out of our forum, and we're going to have initiate a big struggle on this. We're going to start organizing forums all over the state of Minnesota. In fact, I just talked this past Saturday in Thief River Falls, Minnesota, a small community, and over 40 people came out to talk about what we could do to advance the struggle for a real living minimum wage. And I think people are going to have to start doing this all over the country. We've got to get together because we can't rely on these politicians to do our thinking for us, and we can't rely on them to solve our problems.
And, Alan, how can our listeners reach you? And, again, I very much appreciate you joining the program today. But what is your contact information?
Okay, my telephone number is 218-386-2432, or they can Google my blog, the Podunk blog. And, by the way, there's a bunch of pictures from the forum in Duluth on my blog right now. And I hope people will check that out. But all my contact information is on the blog, my cell phone number, my email address, and everything is there.
Alan, in 30 seconds, is there a Labor Party in this country today?
No, that's
a real viable Labor Party. Is there one?
No, there is none, and that's what we need.
So you see the challenge ahead of us for the new Progressive Alliance, and I'm very optimistic. Alan, once again, I enjoyed having you in the program. Look forward to having you to join us again in 2 weeks. And again, I always like to thank Ruth Ann for hosting the program. I'll be looking forward to having our listeners to join us once again for the Socialist Insight. Alan, thanks again. Thank you, Ruth Ann. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Have a good night.
Thanks for having me, Stuart. Ruth Ann.
Good night.
Night.
How's it going, guys? This is Nikolai Brown with Dialectics Radio. This week we got a very special guest. We got Gregory C. Lewis, Sensei Gregory C. Lewis, coming at you from Seattle. He's the host of All Power to the Positive Radio. Before we go into that, got a couple of notices from Weekly Bolshevik. This week we got a presentation in Fort Lauderdale, Stop the TPP, what's going on with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, imperialism behind it. Let's see. Happy Martin Luther King Day. Kind of throw us a token holiday, you know, as part of the pacification campaign against national liberation within the first world and the United States particularly. But beyond that, what else we got going on this weekend? The 23rd in Olympia, there's a presentation by Andrea Smith, Sexual Violence and Mass Incarceration. In San Diego on the 24th, White Solidarity or Wider Opportunism. And then we got a speaking tour that's beginning on the Anishinaabeg Nationhood, West Coast speaking tour that's mostly in Canada. Check that out if you're around there. And then we got the study groups going on. One's in Spanish, Spanish-English, and one's in English, two different study groups in Denver. Check those out as well. So this week, going right into it, we got Gregory C. Lewis. Greg, you there?
I'm here. Peace.
Awesome to hear. How you doing?
Fantastic.
Good, good. So you just got back from a little trip.
I did. I'm still adjusting to the weather. You know, it's very cold, and we finally got some sunshine out, you know, here in this part of the, you know, back in Seattle here, you know, coming from, you know, Mexico City, Oaxaca, San Cristobal, you know, it was like it was cold at night, but during the day, you know, it was fantastic, you know, even with the occasional fog.
I bet. Well, so you just got back from the 20th anniversary of the Zapatista Uprising. What was that all about? What was it like down there? What's the general atmosphere, mood? How are people feeling about the 20th anniversary of that?
You know, it's funny. In San Cristobal proper, there's a lot of support for the Zapatistas and for their movement. You know, for me, you know, it was more of an educational experience than anything else. You know, as I went to the Escuelita that they were holding, and you know, learned a lot about, you know, how they do things, how they have done things, and gained a lot of insights into the, you know, the first world from which I come from, you know, in the process. You know,
cool,
and also shook hands, that's the other thing, too, shook hands and made friends with a whole bunch of people from all over the world.
Gotcha.
So what's
going on with the Zapatistas these days? Just kind of fill the radio audience in.
Well, at this point, they've you know, been shaking hands and making friends all over the various states of Mexico. You know, and I find it interesting that when I was, you know, preparing for this trip, and I was looking at the State Department advisory, and of all the states of Mexico, Chiapas actually didn't have a warning from the State Department. And I find that interesting, you know, especially, you know, considering who's, you know, who really runs it. You know, one thing I think, the thing that really struck me is with the Zapatistas, you know, their whole thing is they encourage other people to do, as, you know, to do their autonomous thing as well. And that's been, you know, rather than this imposed kind of thing or imported sort of thing, that's one of the reasons why they, you know, invite people into their communities to live amongst them and to talk with people and to shake hands and, you know, break bread and really, you know, see how people are living and the reasons why they do certain things and so on. You know, case in point, you know, we're, you know, way up in this, you know, up in the mountains. We went from like about 4,000 feet up into 7,000 feet. And, you know, we had to go 2 hours down this one trail because they had Puristas or party supporters that lived amongst them. Oh, yeah, there's Zapatistas. They're indigenous, but they're getting bankrolled by, you know, the very, you know, whether it's the PRI or the PAN or any of the mainstream political parties in Mexico. And, you know, I asked him, well, is this a recent phenomenon? He's like, no, they've always been amongst us. And I said, well, even during your rising in 1994? He's like, yes. Well, I said, well, how about in the 10 years leading up to that when you guys were preparing to do that very deed? He's like, yes. I said, well, how did you keep them from snitching you out? Well, we just did it. And as he said, they just, you know, they all just said, we just did it. You know, and so that's been, you know, certainly when you're dealing with the first world, you know, that in itself, you know, how they managed to make that happen,
is definitely worth, you know, further investigation, especially given, you know, the national security, insecurity state, surveillance, and also the encouragement of snitchcraft and bribery and so on that goes on in the first world.
Certainly. Well, they got, you know, a slightly different situation, too, where it's, you know, probably much more connected communities as well, as opposed to, you know, here where everybody's kind of disconnected from each other in a sense, kind of mediates everything through electronics and commodities, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. And also, you know, one of the things they even said was one of their big fights is mass media coming from Mexico and, you know, being beamed in. And that was their biggest deal, was around, you know, the priests, a lot of them have, you know, satellite dishes on their roofs, right?
Hmm.
And then that's kind of how you know who's who.
Yeah.
They you know, they get all the latest propaganda from, you know, Televisa or whatever different station is you know, beaming their crap, you know, into the various states. You know, it got so bad in, you know, 2006 that, you know, parents, teachers, and, you know, members of the general public seized about 250 radio stations in Oaxaca and started, you know, broadcasting the truth for once. You know,
yeah.
people were relieved. You know, and to this day, some of those stations still exist. And I got to meet some of the people that, you know, work with those folks, and, you know, they're all very cordial and very serious. You know, I mean, one of the things that also struck me is how, you know, generally, how should we say this, you know, hopeful people were that I met in Mexico, everybody, you know, versus a lot of times, you know, people are very grim and serious about what they're doing. You know, we're in this movement and, you know, and there's just a few of us and this and that, and, you know, and it starts to,
yeah.
you know, it starts to wear on folks. It wears on the individual who's carrying it that way, and it certainly wears on the people around them. So that's another thing I definitely came away with. And that's, you know, quite honestly, you know, especially since I've been in this for so long, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a difficult transition, but it's going to have to happen. And you're definitely going to hear it in the podcast for sure. It's already beginning to happen there on the creative side. So,
all right. Well, we'll look forward to seeing that. obviously, the struggle isn't over in Mexico by any means, just because Zapatistas had an uprising 20 years ago. You know, there's still big problems going on there. They're still the Mexican state. Now you got all sorts of drug cartels that are working with the Mexican state, and plus you got the CIA that are working with the Mexican state and the drug cartels. So what's the general feeling about Mexico about the direction that the movement needs to go?
Well, you know, it's really funny. First of all, like, you know, America, there is a strong disconnect between the movement and the people generally. Now, in Mexico, that disconnect is a little smaller, but it's still there. So the difference in tone on the street, for example, is in Mexico, people acknowledge what's going on in their country. They absolutely bear witness. You know, you're preaching to the choir, but a lot of folks are, keep your head down, mind your own business. You know, you got a family, you got this, you got that, hold on to what little you have. Don't get your door kicked in. There's a lot of that kind of apprehension, you know, versus we're in the States where there's a lot of denial, you know, a lot of wishful thinking, and, you know, especially when, you know, it comes to things that the United States and all of our tax dollars, whether we like it or not, affect in a place like Mexico, and, you know, folks not wanting to openly bear witness to that, you know, in the country from which this problem originates, you know. Especially when you're talking about, you know, repression's an easy one, because those are American weapons, American training, and American bullets, you know, all the way down the line and for generations, you know. I mean, the original Zetas were trained by American soldiers, so,
mm-hmm.
you know, everybody knows. But
didn't one of them get trained at the School of Americas or something like that?
Several. You know, it's really, you know, it comes down to, you know, how much are you willing to pay, because it's one set of expenses to do something like that, to send somebody to the School of Americas versus having law enforcement from the United States come to you and seminar and certify everybody, which they spend about a week or so, and that's what they're doing now all over the world. Seattle police routinely go to Afghanistan and train civilian police officers there, despite the fact they're into their third year under investigation by the FBI for misconduct, abuse, et cetera.
In Afghanistan.
Yeah, they're sent there. Oh, yeah. Every
but, major, but they're under investigation for abuse in Afghanistan.
As well as in Seattle.
Huh.
Right. Yeah.
Well, of course, in Seattle. I mean, I would expect that, but that's just kind of interesting that the... But in any case, but to go back to what's going on in Mexico, so what kind of lessons did you take away specifically? I mean, this must have been a pretty educational, enlightening sort of experience, and especially seeing, you know, it's easy to get bogged down in the States, or if you're from a place like Seattle, or in my case, Denver, where it's like you can get placed in this little bubble where, you know, everyone around you is like, you know, vaguely, you know, socialistic or, you know, a liberal or whatnot, and you can get comfortable, but at the same time, it's just kind of like you're not really going anywhere. And like you said, a lot of people do get kind of grim about it. So what kind of lessons did you learn from this place where there has been this pretty vibrant sort of movement? And that's not to say that it's been like, you know, a perfect movement, but nonetheless, like very vibrant movements in Mexico over the last, you know, 2 decades.
Creativity, creativity, creativity. If you don't bring creativity to the game, nobody's trying to listen to you on any stretch of the imagination at all. They're just not. And that's something that everybody is very much upon, you know, very much on. Even those who aren't really artists, you know, even how they structure conversations, you know, they try to, you know, maximize participation as much as they possibly can. Now, granted, you know, like the States, there is a lot of, you know, middle-class folks involved with it. But, you know, what's nice about them is that they also openly, you know, speak to who they are as a class within this struggle, within this movement. And they're very big on not substituting themselves for the actual, you know, proletariat, you know. And when I'm saying that, I'm talking about the folks that would nominally be out in their rural area, but instead they're, you know, out there on the street hustling, you know, whatever it may be, you know, whether it's beadwork all the way to bags of popcorn, you know, them and their kids running around doing that. Otherwise, they would be potentially in this meeting talking about whatever, you know. And so there's disconnects like that. But, you know, because it's so stark, you have to bear witness to it, you know. And that's, you know, that gives people, you know, and also, you know, the other side of it being the repression, you know. And, you know, there's no... You know, despite all of Nieto's, you know, claims to being some kind of big champion of human rights, there is no human rights there. The only time any kind of human rights even, you know, remotely occurs is because there's an international observer to stand there with a camera when something happens. So that's, you know, and of course, you know, being a place where a third of the economy is based on people sending money home, and the other piece of it is, you know, another big piece of it is tourism. Yeah, they, you know, negative press that affects their bottom line, you know, is a big deal to that government. And that's a weak point. That's a weak point that, you know, folks both there as well as on this, you know, on this side of the border can take note of.
Definitely, and there's not enough of that. I've been to some you know, solidarity rallies with some of the struggles going on in Mexico, and you know, there definitely needs to be more of that, putting pressure on these, you know, comprador governments in the United States and building a movement around that sort of solidarity as well.
Now, here's a piece of good news that I learned as soon as I got back here. So, Michoacan, okay, volunteer defense forces, you know, rising up against the drug cartels there, the Knights Templar,
yeah,
one of the oldest and one of the best, better armed. And, you know, no shortage of interference from the Mexican government, you know, on several occasions. But, and, you know, this kind of ties in from, you know, to where I'm sitting now. There's a woman by the name of Nestoro Salgado from that area, and she has a family in Washington State near Seattle. And she, just shortly before I went to Mexico, she had gone down to Mexico.
And, I think I heard about this. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, she was snatched up by, you know, 20 truckloads of Mexican military for being a leader of this volunteer defense force that's fighting these drug cartels. You know, and you know it's bad when the governor of the state, you know, gives her his written blessing because he bears witness openly that his troops are corrupt, the municipal troops are corrupt, you know the federales corrupt. I mean, he says all this. You know, it's just like, he's just like, I'm done. You know, and good luck to you, you know. And so now, you know, he's getting pressure as well. But
so what's her name again?
Nestora Salgado.
Nestora Salgado, yeah. So people can look that up if they want to find out more information about her. She is still detained, or did she get out?
Oh, yeah. Last time I checked, she was still locked up. There's all kinds of video of her on YouTube, you know, talking about why she's doing what she's doing. But, you know, here's the other thing that's significant is that I just saw a recent article, I believe it was from The Guardian. Facebook friend, of course, went ahead and put it on the wall. And what it talks about is that there's Spanish-speaking folks from East L.A. and places along the border, on this side of the border, who are going down there as volunteers to fight on the side of the volunteer defense forces fighting the cartel.
I saw that, too. That's pretty interesting. And, yeah, it looks like things are really starting to heat up in Mexico. Did you get that feeling whenever you're down there? And that, you know, was there a sense that things were starting to reach a boiling point? Because it seems like it's been so long. I mean, there was a Zapatista movement. And that, you know, it was pretty cool, but it wasn't really like a nationwide thing in May, where, you know, it wasn't whole countrywide in Mexico. It wasn't a revolution per se. It didn't overthrow the Mexican state. In a lot of ways, the conditions in Mexico have even gotten worse since then, especially with, you know, the neoliberal reforms, NAFTA, you know, increasing violence, especially against women. So did you get that sense that people are starting to get a little bit more fed up and looking for more radical alternatives, or, you know, is it still the same old sort of thing?
Honestly, you know, just really depending on what part of Mexico you were in. Now, when I was in, you know, the bigger cities, you know, pretty much it was, you know, dog eat dog. Everybody's kind of out for themselves, but everybody's very polite, you know. You know, San Cristobal, where you still have, you know, a lot of, you know, Zapatistas who come into town to sell their stuff. They have cooperatives right there in the city. You know, you're definitely in the air, and also it's a place where tourists come from other places, you know, specifically looking for that, you know, and especially since they started the Escalitas. You know, so, you know, we have a lot of people coming from out of town, from around the world, that are going to the Zapatista schools and going out to the catacoles and going out even further into the communities themselves, as I did, and studying directly from people who are living that life, as they say. Mm-hmm. And finding out just little things that, you know, definitely haven't been published in any book that I've read, you know, like some of their trading partners, and they trade literally all over the world, you know, uninhibited by Mexican state. And every so often they do try, but they just, you know, they've found that it's just not, you know, for what they're dealing with, you know, there's higher priorities, you know, especially as they're getting money and arms and training from the American government that ostensibly tells them, okay, war on drugs. Well, they have to find reasons then to turn those arms and that training against the Zapatistas. And one of the strategies the Zapatistas use to keep that from happening is they've banned all drugs and alcohol in their communities, you know, not only for the reasons of counterinsurgency, but also because, in their analysis, women and children are affected the most by, you know, the abuse of those things. And so, you know, a long time ago, they banned, you know, all of those kind of substances in their communities.
Yeah, and that's definitely a big problem in parts of Mexico. I mean, do you want to give a little bit of background about what's going on in some of Mexico right now with the auto defenses?
Oh, man. Well, from what I've been gleaning from, you know, because, again, you can't rely on the mass media down there because half of them don't even, you know, put on the television or the radio, anything like, you know, that's going on. But this, you know, most recent thing going on in Michoacán, you know, started off as the volunteers came in and were ostensibly going to arrest the Knights Templar. And the Mexican army intervened and disarmed them, and so they marched in anyway, and the Knights Templar fired on them. Well, then the military was caught in the position of, like, gee, we better protect these unarmed civilians, or we're going to look bad, you know, because there's journalists there and everything else, you know, human rights observers who had already been there. So those defense forces left. They got more arms, came back with more people, and eventually the Mexican military had to, you know, just basically back up into a defensive position and let these two sides fight it out, you know. And so now at this time, you know, from what I've read, there's, you know, volunteers coming from, you know, Spanish-speaking communities all throughout California and along the border towns. So,
and it's kind of ironic because the U.S. is giving the Mexican state all this weapons and money to fight this so-called war on drugs, and, you know, here you got these communities that are, you know, able to do it pretty effectively, pretty quickly, whereas the Mexican state's ineffective. And then you get the Mexican state turn around and basically turn on these community groups, which kind of shows you what side the Mexican state's really on when it comes to the drug war. And the same thing with the U.S. for that matter. And that's the last thing that it seems like the Mexican state wants, is the continuation of these armed self-defense groups in parts of Mexico, western central Mexico and elsewhere.
And here's the other thing, too, because already in Detroit you have groups there who are doing something similar, although not as on a grand scale, you know. In other words, they have, you know, arms like, you know, less lethal weaponry and so on, but they're basically private security. And so, you know, those groups exist, but in, you know, the case of the first world, they serve the state as opposed to opposing it, you know, or stepping into a space that the state ostensibly would normally fill, but no longer does. You know, whereas they claim, you know, whether in this country they will claim that, oh, the state should fulfill this particular policing role, but they're not because my neighbor had this or that happen to them, so now I'm going to fulfill it with my private organization. And, you know, they're doing that in Detroit, Oakland, different cities, you know, especially where there's, you know, more gated communities and such, you know.
Yeah.
But the nature of it is very different, very different.
Yeah, very reactionary. It sounds like, you know, kind of white fear vigilante types.
Yeah, a whole lot of Zimmerman type things, you know, dancing in their heads, I'm sure. But what's interesting,
yeah,
the Detroit one, you know, is all black.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. And so,
now,
you know,
and they were,
I mean,
still kind of serving the moneyed interests and everything.
Well, that, but also here's the thing, you know, in Detroit, the city government was basically taken over by, you know, by the state. They have an auditor and all this stuff because of all the corruption, and that includes the police department, which went bankrupt. So they have very few officers now. So now they have in those places, in certain neighborhoods, they now have these security forces, you know, and
mm-hmm.
so that. You know, so on the one hand, yeah, extremely reactionary, but also as we've seen with, you know, hell, even Vietnam, you know, especially if folks that came out of Vietnam and joined, you know, organizations like the Panther Party and so on, you know, there's also a small layer of potential within that, you know, despite the reactionary nature of that, you know, overall.
Yeah, there's definitely an element of the neoliberalization of policing, seeing the privatization of you know, a lot of security, and that becoming a big part of the overall economy of the world. And you were seeing that a little bit in Mexico, right? Private policing.
Oh yeah.
What's that?
I mean, layers of private security, and just, I mean, you know, my laptop, you know, went through their little customs and was destroyed by a group of teenagers, like straight up. Like, you know,
so what do you mean,
customs
or private security?
They were like, they're private, but they fulfill the role of their customs.
Hmm.
And so they just, yeah. Like the guy who actually stamps your passport, he's actually officially customs. But the people who actually look at your bags, you know, they're a private contractor. And, you know, it's all teenagers. And they, you know, sat there and dropped my laptop and banged it in and out of the machine and just, you know. And it was not, it was just, you know, folks just being careless. I'm sure it was late, coming into the end of the day, you know, and just, you know, just destroyed.
I'm sorry to hear.
I mean, you know, but, you know, it doesn't stop the show because, you know, got back over here and rescued the data off of it and went to another rig and, you know, put it together and then, you know, boom, it's up there. You know, it's a lot of the rare speeches from Dr. King that they don't teach in the schools in America.
Yeah, well, even the whole concept of Martin Luther King Day, in a way, is, you know, they pick the most lily-white leader they can, in a sense, and then they kind of erase a lot of the militant history. You know, they don't teach people about Robert F. Williams, for example, in grade schools and high schools and things like that. So they kind of throw out this one token holiday. I don't know how it is in Seattle, but in Denver it was kind of like a parade of nonprofit organizations. So, it's, you know, kind of like the poverty pimp holiday almost.
Oh, yeah, we definitely have that element here. I mean, but the contradictions, you know, people see them because they're coming out, you know, coming to the surface very quickly. I mean, so, for example, how is it that the chairman of the Martin Luther King Day Committee in Seattle is also the same one advocating for the expansion of the juvenile jail, you know, to include retail and market rate housing on top of it? How's that work? And he used to claim the, you know, the Panther legacy because he was part of the Black Student Union. You know, how's that work? But yet here he is, you know, leading this thing. You know, what was even more interesting, a lot of the support base around Africatown, went to the festivities today, but actually participated by having seminars there and whatnot. So I was unable to attend as still banned from, you know, school district property.
Well, let's back up for a second because we're getting in totally different territory. We're talking about kind of what's going on in Seattle now. And why don't you – a lot of people don't know necessarily who you are, what you've been about. You've been around for a long time. You used to work with anarchist people of color and all sorts of groups. I think you got a radio show. You got two radio shows, something like that, All Power to the Positive. What's the other one you got that's local in Seattle?
Oh, Zulu Radio. Yeah, I'm on every
Saturday. You guys got to get, like, you got to have some downloadable versions of your shows because I never catch it whenever it's live. And, I see the set list and it always looks good. But so if you're in Seattle, you definitely got to check out Greg on the ones and twos and everything. But tell everybody about kind of your political history, how you came into all of this, what motivates you today and all of that.
Well, I mean, quite honestly, the whole thing, you know, for me, I mean, everybody has their incident or set of incidents and, you know, and things that happen to them that, you know, push them in a direction. And for me, probably being pulled off a bus for the very first time as a black man by the police and being accused of stealing, you know, along with four other black men, and, having one of the cops threaten to shoot me in the head. You know, I mean, that was kind of a wake-up call. And that was when I was on my way to work. I was, I had just dropped out of high school around that time. And, you know, the boss was cool about it because he knew, he was aware. So you fast forward to about 92, and in that year, you know, a whole bunch of things. First of all, I just moved out on my own, and a whole bunch of things were happening all at the same time in the city. One, there was a huge squatting movement that was happening around the U District. On top of that, you had the city attorney trying to, pass laws, to ban sitting or lying down on the sidewalk. Hmm. And then the third thing, the third thing was the skinheads, and they were everywhere, and they were, beating people up and carrying on. And then the final thing that happened in that year was the Rodney King Rebellion. And so the other 66-some-odd cities that went up besides, Los Angeles, well, one of them was Seattle. So after that, that's when I became a committed revolutionary, and I have been ever since.
Gotcha.
So that's 21 years in the game, 22 years
and
as of April.
Yeah, I mean, and you got, like, a pretty expansive sort of background reference of knowledge, too. I mean, talking to you, you'll throw out references to Islam and Nation of Islam, and then, you've done some work with anarchist people of color, so you have that whole background. I know you know a little bit about Marxism. I've definitely seen some comments you make on Facebook and stuff, regarding debates and everything. So how do you bring all this together? I mean, where do you come from politically, I suppose?
Well, I mean, it's like a long time ago I had an elder ask me, he said, well, we know what you're against, so what are you for, So, I broke it down very succinctly, and that's on the blog, allpowertothepositive.blogspot.com. you know, what I want. Okay, reparations. And I mean, when I talk about reparations, not just for black people and for all the things we went through in slavery, but also talking about, you know, the, you know, what Ross Perot called that sucking sound, you know, back in the 80s, and that's, you know, the America, you know, sucking from the third world and the global south, whatever you want to call it. So those folks are going to need some reparations too. You know, self-determination. Well, self-determination is everything from, you know, a state of oppressed people, you know, separating off and becoming, you know, a state of some type, all the way to how even those people identify themselves, you know, because especially in America, you know, black people, a lot of black people's identity was rooted in what our oppressor, you know, viewed and thought of us, you know, direct worker control. You know, when we say that, you know, not just industry, but also the community itself. You know, it doesn't matter if you have, you know, black-owned businesses or, you know, black-owned, you know, or, you know, even, you know, equality on the shop floor or whatever, if you're still paying taxes to, you know, a racist authoritarian government that bombs the hell out of your fellow worker all over the world, you know, and oftentimes tests a lot of that stuff on you and your kids before they do, you know. So, I mean, you know, just, you know, and then also, too, having, you know, political parties that go through your religious organizations and through your religious leaders to get you to move in one direction or the other, you know, as it is now. You know, that's definitely not, it's like what Huey Newton talked about, where he said that, you know, the white man just can't come into the community and just start barking orders. No, no one's going for that. But instead he finds, you know, a one or two or a group to speak through. And so that kind of thing, you know, so that undermines direct worker control. You know, and then, of course, a global economy based upon the principle of from each according to ability to each according to need. You know, now, how we get there, you know, that's a bigger question. But those are some, you know, some basic, you know, things that I feel, you know, need to happen and have to be definitely, you know, at the very least carefully thought about, you know, and, you know, defined and redefined.
Yeah. Certainly. I mean, yeah, it certainly leaves a lot of open questions as well. I mean, it doesn't pretend to have all the answers, I suppose.
No one's running around here with a crystal ball, you know, and we have plenty of organizations that, you know, take us backwards into, you know, organizational and personal cultism, you know, within the movement. You know, you have the folks that are, you know, pray to the chairman or, you know, pray to this long-dead leader, or pray to this idea that didn't work so well before, you know. I mean, just, you know, or cling to this particular ideal. You know, it doesn't matter, you know. And that's, you know, I mean, like we have plenty of religious denominations that will keep you, you know, going through that circle. And they'll do it better because, they'll, you know, some of them will even make sure that you can, you know, get a little bit of food here and there and maybe get a voucher to keep your lights on, you know.
I'm cracking up right now, man. All right, yeah. No, I totally agree. We define that more, because I've heard you talk about that. Like, so this cultism, like, what exactly do you mean?
Well, I mean, an easy one is to start with what Marx actually said. You know, when his stepson was running around talking about he's a Marxist and he got a Marxist group, you know, a reporter asked him, and he said, "I assure you, sir, I am no Marxist." You know? So, I mean, you start putting ifs and isms on things, you know, if you're not, you know, careful in your definition, you know, pretty soon, you know, what you get is a little click. You know, because concrete reality around you opposes what you're trying to do, and you haven't found a way to navigate that, you know?
Well,
I mean, the Bolsheviks went through that for years and years and years. They went through that until they figured out, okay, well, first of all, you know, in our country, we have to do a lot of shit secretly, you know, and then later on, the things got worse. Pretty soon, they're, you know, Lenin's getting notes in prison from his jailers going, "Hey, you know what, you got a point, and we'll help you any way we can." It's like, oh, shit, really? You know, I mean, that's a whole other different, you know, shift of paradigm there, you know. And so, you know, what a lot of, you know, religious people do is they, you know, they go deeper into their dogma, you know, and that's why I see a lot of Marxists and, you know, anarchists and black nationalists and, you know, folks like that getting off into. And that's why I kept it really basic with what, you know, what I want and what I want to see. You know, all those different isms, you know, all those different churches, all those different houses, you know, they have, you know, everybody's got a piece of the truth, but everybody wants to, you know, front like they have the whole of the truth. And that's not, That's not material reality, you know.
Well, don't you?
Nothing is unknown, but people are still unaware of certain things, you know.
Certainly, no, I definitely agree with that. But I mean, I guess I would say it. Sometimes it seems like it's useful to be able to make those distinctions between different ideologies, different thoughts. And then on the other hand, I do think we can say that some ideas are a little bit more correct than others. I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that or.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, my whole thing is everybody brings something to the table, you know, and, you know, what is the end goal? What are we trying to do here? You know, let's keep at, you know, what's the big picture, you know? Sure, everybody's got their individual smaller goals for their locale or even their country, you know. But what's the big one, you know? Ending, you know, oppression. That's a big one, but that's, you know, and there's all kinds of, you know, little details involved with that. But that's what everybody's aiming for, or you're not. You know, it's one or the other, regardless of what kind of label you put on yourself. You know, liberals are great ones to go, especially, the Hillary Clinton and, you know, those kind of people running around, you know, wagging the finger at everybody all over the world, you know, and they really are in no place to talk, you know, about, you know, peace or any of that with anybody, you know. In fact, they really want to go ahead and have the conversation with themselves in the mirror, you know. There's a reason that your Hillary Clintons and people like that, you notice that they age very quickly once they have that position, you know. Obama, too, he's going gray real quick, you know.
Why's that?
Well, I mean, the level of stress involved.
Yeah, of course.
If you're doing dirt to people, you should be stressed out. You know, you should be looking over your shoulder at all times. So that lets you know who they are, you know.
Well, I'd hope
right
so,
there.
But...
You know, even Hugo Chavez, I mean, he didn't start looking bad until he started really coming to the end, you know. For the most part, he was eating good, and, you know, he was, you know, he had that healthy teeth and shiny coat, as they say, you know. Wasn't wearing a bunch of makeup when he would appear in front of the TV cameras, you know, and he'd still go, you know, go ham for an hour nonstop or however long, you know, sometimes longer, you know, talking about whoever and whatever, you know, taking calls from the audience, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's take it back to Seattle. So you guys had a bunch of struggles there recently over the Horace Mann building. So tell us about that. What's the background? How did it all start off?
Well, we have to go way back in time, you know, if we really want to get to the real beginning of it. We go back to, you know, the hell of the 60s and 70s. And, you know, at that time, you had that contention between folks who are just looking for civil rights and those who were seeking actual liberation. And a lot of liberation forces were, you know, vying to create, you know, their own institutions, right? And so, over time, these things would come and go for, you know, based upon what was going on in the community and the various personalities involved, until finally, there was going to be a police precinct put right in the community. So people were like, hell to know, and there was already an empty house there, so people took it over and said they wanted to create an African-American Heritage Museum and Cultural Center. So they occupied it, and eventually the bulldozers came and grabbed everybody and knocked the building down, but they never built the precinct there. No, instead they just put the fire station there instead. So fast forward a few years to 1983, and they go and they seize the Coleman School. And so from the Coleman School, they occupied that until 1998. And so, you know, until finally they sent the SWAT team in there, and it was the SWAT team that, you know, eventually drove the activists out of there. So, but it took a while. So, you know, later on we established the Mojave Peace Center up the street at 23rd and Spring. Or 24th and Spring, excuse me, and held that until they, you know, started overflowing with students, and then that's when we moved over to Horace Mann, or the beginnings of Africatown. And so the concept being that, first when we went into that school, there was only one program going on there. It's a, you know, three-story school, and there's only 15 kids studying there.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, exactly. And this woman who was running it was getting money from the city. However, she was running it through a church organization. And when that was brought to the attention of her church, none of them even knew she was doing that. So that turned into a whole, you know, a whole bunch of ball of confusion and everything else. So she moves, and another group that was there continues on. That's the Armistead School, and they were doing Spanish immersion classes for kids. And so they were going to renegotiate their lease. The school district was giving them, you know, blowing a bunch of smoke up their butt. So they said, fine, we're out of here, and they went to another building. So that left us there. And so we continued doing, you know, programming as well as, you know, negotiating with them. All kinds of, you know, promises made and never kept. I mean, just, you know, it goes, I mean, there, you can go to the moreforman.org site. You can also go to allpowertothepositive.blogspot.com and just, you know, see the video of all the different times that they, you know, made these promises, whether it is Superintendent Banda or the assistant, you know, superintendent. You know, they agree that there is problems with, you know, oppressed people, you know, particularly youth, being kicked out of school for these indefinite periods of time for relatively minor offenses. They also see the dropout rate. I mean, they bear witness to all this stuff, and, oh, they swear up and down how they are so supportive of Africatown, but then they, you know, make bureaucratic and extra-legal maneuvers, and, you know, ultimately you have, like, you know, the whole national security state now floating around this thing because, you know, here we are in Seattle, you know, where black people are only 2% of the entire state's population, mostly concentrated on the west coast of the state. You know, essentially seizing a building and, you know, basically, you know, running programs and doing all the things that a school district is purportedly supposed to do with the tax dollars of its public. You know, so you can imagine, you know, if, you know, parents in Chicago and activists in Chicago, you know, over there, they've already, Rahm Emanuel's pretty close, like some 56 some odd schools. You can imagine, you know, with a larger black population, if all of those folks started doing as we were doing.
Let's start taking the schools and running them yourself. So explain to us, what exactly is Africatown?
Africatown is basically a concept. It's kind of like, you know, with your different, you know, different cities that have a Chinatown. You go there, you know, the signage is in Chinese. You have the different, you know, cultural centers, restaurants, et cetera, to cater to Chinese people. And some also, too, sometimes, you know, different Asian ethnicities, be it Japanese, et cetera. So likewise with Africatown, especially now we have this big influx of folks coming from Somalia and Eritrea, you know, coming into Seattle, you know, we took it, you know, we as, you know, African diaspora in America, you know, said this might be a good time, you know, to introduce this concept, especially to the young people, you know, so they have a sense of belonging and as well as, you know, an alternative to essentially what is, which essentially means you leave your community, you know, you try to get a job with some corporation someplace, maybe you do some kind of hustle to get you caught up, and now you're working for a corporation from inside prison walls. So, you know, doing something there to deal, you know, around the specific issue of education, but ultimately dealing with, you know, the issues surrounding colonialism and neocolonialism in particular in the first world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like an interesting example of a dual power struggle that you don't see too often in the United States.
People are afraid of doing it. You know, it was funny. I was listening to some audio of a town hall that Al Sharpton had thrown in Chicago. And, you know, it was interesting how many people essentially alluded to the creation of a dual power situation of a type. And that's something that the Zapatistas have achieved, you know. And so that's something that we can look at just on, you know, on that level, you know, because that is significant, you know. And also, you know, different groups in Oaxaca are also following suit and reaching out and shaking hands with the Zapatistas, especially after the Subcomandante made his tour around the country. So,
And
there's things to be, you know, certainly the the way in which, you know, people socialize and, you know, what they call, you know, that piece is called the, you know, the encounters that they have, you know, where people really just take time to listen. Super important. And that's something that, you know, first world folks can for sure, you know, learn and emulate a lot better than we have been.
Certainly. Do you want to explain to the audience what dual power is a little bit better, because some people might not know?
Well, I mean, you know, and essentially, you know, when you have dual power, usually the situation is that whatever existing government is there is in a weakened state, and a new form of power, be it a popular assembly or, you know, some kind of government structure of deputies and that sort of thing, has been, you know, created by, you know, usually by the workers themselves. You know, as the case was in Bolshevik Russia, shortly before they had the revolution there in 1917. You also had that, you know, in Spain in 1936 through 39, where you had the different anarchist trade unions, where they would actually run the functions of society, everything from food distribution to, you know, arming their troops against Franco and his people, you know. So it always looks slightly different in each place, but usually it comes about through, you know, drafted struggle. I mean, a really great case in point, of course, would be, you know, the Maoist model, you know, where, you know, Mao and his folks already came to a situation where the peasants were already seizing land and, you know, punishing landlords and carrying on. So they just, all they added to the game was more of a sense of permanence and dealing with, you know, basic services, you know, things like, you know, especially, you know, out there in the middle of nowhere, you're doing your farming or whatever, you know, you get hurt and there's no hospital that's nearby. So now having some trained folks who can reattach your limbs or fight infection or, you know, bringing that kind of stuff to the game and bringing the idea that, okay, now once this landlord's taken out of power, we don't let him come back because he's, you know, he's promised you this or that. Like, no, no, no. You know, now you, peasant, you are in power, you know, and we're going to, and the trend, you know, the organizational means, of course, is, the, you know, this party here. And so that's what they, you know, that was so they, you know, people think that, you know, they get this idea they just kind of took over. It's like, no, actually the peasants looked at the organizational structure and said, yeah, that makes sense, you know, based upon what they knew, you know, and then they learned more, you know, and so on. And each generation that got in it, depending on the needs of the society, you know, and what was going on at the time politically, would learn from it, you know. So that's, you know, and likewise, even with the Zapatistas, similar type of thing as they, you know, work out how they organize and how they interact with people from the outside world, you know. So there is no, there's just the only way, and it's like, nah, you have to look at the history of a particular place to see what makes sense, you know. I mean, you know, these folks said, oh, it's only got to be this one way, it's only going to be, you know, and it's like, well, can you prove that, you know, because the last person who said all that, you know, whether it's, oh, it's always got to be people's war, okay, well, the last guy who was pushing that is still locked up. You know, next to the guy who was charged with hunting him down, okay, you know, they share a wall, you know, in the same prison.
They're,
you know,
talking,
so
to each other,
like,
top.
You know, so I mean, you know, but I mean, seriously, I mean, it's just, you know, we got to get away from this, you know, the hero worship, you know, because that's part of the spookism, you know. It's just
it does seem like dual power has been a you know, a common feature in a lot of revolutions, be it the Russian, the Chinese, the Iranian, you know, that there was that kind of seed or that start of the new power within the old, I suppose, and that people were already starting to coalesce around these new institutions that represented them better than the old ones.
Hey, the Paris Commune, you know, 30,000 communards weren't put to death simply because of they had a political disagreement. No, they had power, and the, you know, the established power wasn't having it. They were like, we want to make sure this doesn't come back ever again. And in to make sure of that, the other thing they did was they deported a whole bunch of folks to at the time was a penal colony called New Caledonia. Later on, New Caledonia became its own, you know, sovereign state. And today, you know, because back in the day it was also a slave plantation, today the descendants of the communards are now the reactionaries, the descendants of the slaves, have to deal with on that island with the economic issues and social issues that plague them, you know, in this day and age.
Huh. That's an interesting bit of history. I don't know if you were aware. We actually were talking about New Caledonia last week on the program.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's okay. Pretty interesting. If you get a chance, check out the It's on the Archive at the website. Cool. Hey, I just wanted to ask you one last question. I was just looking at your website, allpowertothepositive.blogspot.com, and I saw this progressive wind farms versus the Oaxacan people. What's that kind of about? You want to give a quick – we got about 4 minutes left, maybe a two-minute rundown on what that's all about?
Okay, so that was actually a video that was shown to me during this presentation that I attended over at the Universidad de Tejada. And basically, you know, what it was is that the Mexican state is given contracts to, you know, ostensibly these environmentally friendly American companies to build these wind farms in rural areas. Well, the problem is that the people who live on this land haven't given their permission for any of that, you know. Also, they're not getting paid for any of that. And they've resisted to the point where, you know, you have the you know, the state sending in, you know, assassins and carrying on, you know, you know, poisoning wells and doing all that kind of stuff, trying to get people off their land so these things can be built.
Wow.
And so, yeah. And so that's, yeah, that's, you know, because, you know, one of the things that, you know, they that was, you know, emphasized to me was that they're talking, especially they're talking about, you know, the 1910 revolution. And, you know, the big issue was land distribution to the farmers. And that's part of, you know, their constitution called Article 27. Well, from the beginning, you know, a whole bunch of landholders, most of them foreign, utilized that law to their own advantage. And over time, you know, various political parties until finally the current regime under Nieto have essentially stripped Article 27 from the constitution in any functional way. So that's, you know, so that's, you know, kind of, you know, the background. And see, they're, you know, really, you know, they're really, you know, something's about to happen down there where you have, you know, mostly, you know, like predominantly rural people getting their land taken all over the country by various forces, you know, and that's in addition to, you know, the streets of their cities and towns being made unsafe by these narcos.
Gotcha. Yeah, well, neoliberal imperialism. All right, well, that's about all the time we got. Are there any projects or anything like that you want to plug? Was that More for Man website one more time?
Yeah, moreforman.org. Also, allpowertothepositive.info. And inyourfaceradio.net, we're also on there. We're slowly expanding our reach to other networks, so check us out. You know, just Google us.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on. That was pretty informative. Hopefully you can join us again. You know, everybody should check out All Power to the Positive. Definitely a different format. I'm Nikolai Brown. Be sure to check out antiimperialism.com, revolutionaryecology.com, revolutionaryaim.org, and we'll catch you next week. Oh, yeah, by the way, we got Molly Yeshiteli coming on. So, yeah, see you then.